Acatra Foundation presents the Acatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Acatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. You know, we take these really comprehensive sources on big topics, and we try to pull out the essential truth for you, saving you, well, potentially hundreds of hours of reading.
And today we're doing something I think is pretty profound, actually, a necessary reintroduction, maybe, to a figure we all think we know so well. We're diving into the complex reality of Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah, and we're guided mainly by Jonathan Eig's, frankly, monumental 2023 biography, King, A Life.
It's a really critical book, this one, because it uses source material that just wasn't available before. You've got newly declassified FBI files, loads of personal archives.
Exactly. So our mission here really is to try and strip away that sort of idealized image, the marble monument we see every January, almost lifeless, you know?
Mm-hmm. We all know the peaceful dreamer, the icon.
Right. But the source material, Eig's book especially, it reveals this brilliant, yes, but also deeply flawed man.
Yeah.
Someone who was often profoundly depressed. And his radical transformation, it came at this incredible personal cost.
We really want to show you the king who is grappling, really struggling with fear, with guilt, with these relentless hostile enemies.
Because that very human struggle, we think, is what ultimately makes his courage just so inspiring and so relevant for you today.
Definitely.
Okay, let's unpack this. Maybe we should start right at the beginning, because the book really emphasizes this paradox of his childhood.
Yeah, he was born Michael King Jr. back in Atlanta in 1929. And his family had, you know, relative privilege. His father, Daddy King, was this very powerful, very successful Baptist minister.
And that privilege, it created a really unique psychological situation, didn't it?
It really did. On the one hand, it kind of insulated him from the most visceral, the daily grind of Jim Crow poverty for many. But on the other hand, it made the injustice itself maybe even more acutely visible.
How so?
Well, it showed that segregation wasn't just about economics, right? It was about these completely arbitrary, these artificial barriers that were put up even against successful Black Americans. It was about dignity, fundamentally.
And what's fascinating here is how Eig shows that external reality mixing with a really intense internal one.
Yeah, the book spends quite a bit of time on King's psychological complexity, specifically this deep-seated guilt he carried.
He was apparently tremendously sensitive and, you know, often blamed himself for things totally outside his control, like his grandmother's death. He irrationally connected it to something he did.
That's such a critical point Eig makes, this heavy, almost, yeah, irrational sense of guilt, this overwhelming personal responsibility. It didn't paralyze him.
No.
Instead, it seems like it sort of channeled itself into this intense drive towards service, towards self-sacrifice. It's like he needed to do something, you know, to redeem the suffering he felt somehow responsible for.
Turning a private burden into a public motivation.
Exactly. Which sets up this really interesting tension when you look at his intellectual life.
Right, because he was clearly brilliant, precocious, skipped grades, started Morehouse College incredibly young.
Mm-hmm. But then Eig's research, it forces us to confront these academic controversies, specifically instances of what's called patch writing. It's basically plagiarism found in his student papers and even in his doctoral dissertation.
Okay, so this is where the humanity really hits hard, maybe.
Yeah.
Because just saying he plagiarized, that feels incomplete somehow.
It does. And the book tries to provide context. It's framed less as like a fundamental moral failing, although the ethics are complex, and more as a consequence of this crushing pressure combined with maybe a profound intellectual insecurity.
Wait, but if he was already so brilliant, why the insecurity? Why the shortcuts? Doesn't that kind of let a major moral leader off the hook?
Well, the biography suggests it's about trying to manage these impossible expectations and doing it quickly. He was sort of operating in two worlds at once, right?
Hmm.
You have the tradition of the Black church where borrowing sermons, synthesizing, that was pretty common practice. And then you have the really rigorous, often, frankly, hostile white academic world he was trying to break into.
So intense pressure to prove himself worthy.
Exactly. Leading to maybe a degree of haste, self-doubt. It's a powerful reminder, I think, that he achieved greatness while fighting some very real personal limitations.
Hmm. So that academic journey, despite those internal struggles, it really became his intellectual crucible.
Yeah. He goes to Morehouse, meets Dr. Benjamin E. Mays. King called him his spiritual father.
And Mays introduces him to the social gospel. Okay, for you listening, what does the social gospel actually mean in simple terms?
Basically, it's this pretty radical idea for the time that Christianity's main job isn't just about personal salvation, you know, for the next life.
Right.
It's about social transformation now. The core work of a Christian, according to the social gospel, is to build the kingdom of God right here on earth. And you do that by fighting social evils. Poverty, racism.
That became his bedrock.
Yeah, absolutely. And from that foundation, King then starts to forge his core philosophy. And Eich shows it wasn't just simple idealism. It was this really sophisticated blend, a synthesis of three major forces.
Okay, so we got the foundation. Christian theology, that moral imperative, and the concept of agape, unconditional love.
Right. Then he adds the method, the tool set. Gandhian nonviolence. Satyagraha.
And it's crucial to understand, this wasn't passive resistance, was it?
Not at all. Satyagraha literally translates to something like truth force or soul force. It's an active spiritual and political strategy. It aims to coerce, yes, but through moral force, seeking the transformation, even the redemption of the opponent.
Aiming for that beloved community he always talked about.
Yeah.
Where everyone belongs.
Exactly. And then the third ingredient, the one that makes him such a shrewd strategist, is Reinhold Niebuhr's Christian realism.
Hold on, Niebuhr. A Christian realist.
Yeah.
How does that kind of hard-nosed pragmatism fit with King's nonviolent idealism? It seems contradictory.
Well, that tension, that's the genius of King's strategy, isn't it? Niebuhr taught him a really brutal truth, that moral suasion alone, just appealing to people's better angels, would never be enough to compel privileged groups to give up power.
Okay, I see.
Niebuhr's realism acknowledged collective evil. Institutional power structures, things that have to be confronted actively through nonviolent coercion and disruption, not just, you know, polite requests.
So that realization basically moved King from being a preacher just talking about love to a strategist actively organizing power.
Precisely. It's that blend of the idealist's vision with the realist's methodology.
But even with all this intellectual firepower, Eich really emphasizes he was, initially anyway, a pretty reluctant leader.
Oh, very much so. He actually desperately wanted an academic career, a quiet life, scholarship. Taking the pastor job in Montgomery, Alabama was almost like a geographic accident.
And then history happens. Rosa Parks' arrest in 1955. Suddenly this 26-year-old PhD is thrust into leading the Montgomery bus boycott.
He didn't seek the spotlight at all. The movement basically imposed it on him.
Which brings us to maybe the most powerful private moment that Eich reveals in the biography. This was his first major turning point, the kitchen table epiphany in Montgomery, 1956. Tell us about that night.
Yeah, I mean, his life at that point was just completely unsustainable. He was getting constant death threats. His house had just been bombed. His family was in danger.
Terrifying.
Absolutely. So he's sitting alone at his kitchen table late one night, just consumed by fear for his young family. And he was ready to quit, just walk away from the movement entirely.
Wow. And it's right there, in that moment of just absolute vulnerability, that the transformation occurs.
Exactly. He describes this mystical, very deep experience, feeling a divine presence, hearing an inner voice promising to stand with him, never to leave him alone.
That private moment, it fortified him.
It completely shifted him from this, you know, frightened, hesitant intellectual to an unwavering prophet, someone with this almost unbreakable sense of destiny. His strength became rooted not in his own power, but in this total dependence on something larger.
That strength was definitely tested, fiercely. 7 years later, bringing us to our second turning point, the letter from Birmingham jail in 1963.
Right. And King deliberately chose Birmingham, didn't he? He knew confronting the police chief, Bull Connor, would provoke a violent reaction.
Which was necessary for media visibility, unfortunately.
Exactly. So he gets arrested, put in solitary confinement, and it's there, on scraps of paper, newspaper margins, that he writes this absolutely definitive text.
The sheer brilliance of that letter, it's dual purpose, isn't it?
Totally. First, yeah, it gives the classic definition of civil disobedience, how you distinguish between a just law, one that uplifts human personality, and an unjust law, one that degrades it.
Makes sense.
But second, and maybe even more critically back then, it just skewered the white moderates.
Ah, yes. The ones more devoted to order than to justice.
Precisely. Challenging those who prioritize the absence of tension over the presence of justice. That critique, well, it still lands pretty hard today, doesn't it?
It really does. That same year, 1963, brought his political apex, the March on Washington.
Ah.
And our third turning point We all know the I have dreams speech, but Ig highlights a critical detail about how it actually came about.
Yeah, this is fascinating. King actually had this meticulously prepared speech ready to go, very structured, focused on policy, legislative demands.
Pretty dry, maybe?
Could have been. But then, right in the middle of delivering it, the gospel singer Mahalia Jackson, who was nearby, apparently called out, "Tell him about the dream, Martin."
Wow. And he just went off script.
Completely. Discarded his notes and improvised, just launched into that preacherly rhythm, that vision, creating one of the most powerful rhetorical moments, well, ever.
It solidified his iconic status.
Yeah.
The hopeful dreamer.
It did. But as Ig points out, it was kind of a double-edged sword, that beautiful, universally digestible vision of, you know, little children holding hands. It inadvertently constrained his legacy in some ways.
How so?
Well, the public really embraced the dreamer, which made it much harder for them to accept the increasingly radical, the policy-focused prophet he was already becoming.
Because after 1965, particularly after the Voting Rights Act, the scope of his mission started to radically shift, didn't it?
Massively. He grew more and more isolated, convinced that desegregation, while crucial, was only a first step. He realized the fight had to pivot from securing basic civil rights to confronting these huge structures of economic inequality.
Yeah, we see that frustration play out most clearly in the Chicago failure in 1966.
Oh, yeah. He tried to export the Southern nonviolent model to the North, to Chicago, but he found himself battling this insidious de facto racism. It wasn't clear-cut Jim Crow laws like in the South.
No Bull Connor to easily villainize.
Exactly. Instead, he faced these entrenched systemic issues. Housing discrimination, deep poverty, political machines, just widespread apathy. It was diffuse, incredibly hard to organize against.
And it yielded few clear victories.
Very few. But that experience, that frustration, it really radicalized his analysis even further.
Which then culminates in 1967 with what many see as the final major turning point, that devastating Beyond Vietnam speech.
Devastating is right. The cost to his reputation, his alliances, it was immense.
He called out the U.S. government directly
as
the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Strong words.
Incredibly strong. He alienated the press, completely destroyed his working relationship with President Johnson. Many of his mainstream liberal allies just abandoned him.
But intellectually, that speech solidified his mature framework, didn't it?
It did. This framework, which is maybe the most important policy tool King left us, was his unified critique of what he called the triple evils,
which were racism, extreme materialism, or poverty, and militarism.
And what's fascinating here is how he connected them. He argued very forcefully that these are not separate problems. You can't tackle one without tackling the others.
So the logic is, if you fund a massive military-industrial complex, escalate wars like Vietnam,
you inevitably defund the domestic programs you need to tackle poverty, which disproportionately impacts marginalized communities, which in turn perpetuates racism. It's all interconnected.
It's a systemic critique, pretty revolutionary, really, of America's core priorities.
Absolutely. And the personal cost of taking the stand was just unimaginable. This is where Ig's use of those declassified FBI files really brings the human drama, the pressure, into focus. J. Edgar Hoover's FBI waged this relentless campaign against him, COINTELPRO.
They monitored his personal life obsessively, his extramarital affairs.
And infamously sent that suicide package, a tape recording, supposedly, of his affairs, along with this anonymous note urging him to kill himself before the tapes were made public.
It's chilling. The goal was just total destruction, his reputation, his influence.
And that level of constant aggressive harassment, Ig argues, heavily contributed to the profound depression and exhaustion King felt in his final years. I mean, imagine it, fighting the U.S. government, the white power structure, segregationists, and increasingly battling internal self-doubt fueled by this state-sponsored attack.
It's almost unbearable to think about.
Yet, despite all that impossible pressure, his final vision was maybe his most ambitious yet, the Poor People's Campaign.
Right. An interracial coalition demanding economic justice, not just civil rights, but economic rights.
Mm-hmm.
He was organizing that right up until he was assassinated in Memphis in 1968.
Yeah.
So, okay, bringing this all together, what does this incredibly complex human story mean for you, the listener, today? Navigating our own complexities, our own moral decisions. Ig's biography feels like it offers a kind of roadmap maybe through contradiction and crisis.
I think so. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the true measure of King, perhaps, is found right there in his struggle. You know, we often dismiss the courage of saints or heroes because they seem superhuman, untouchable.
Right, like it was easy for them.
Exactly. But King's story, this biography, really proves his courage was earned. It was forged in constantly fighting fear, fighting weakness, fighting depression.
Okay, so let's try and distill three final takeaways from this really humanizing portrait I paint.
All right. First, maybe an emotional insight. The man we celebrate behind the monument, he was constantly, constantly fighting fear and depression. His courage wasn't the absence of fear, it was the will to act in spite of it.
That's powerful. His strength came from that struggle against his own weakness, his self-doubt, and that kind of strength, that's potentially available to all of us.
Absolutely. Second, an intellectual insight. The enduring relevance, really the necessity of that triple evils framework.
Racism, poverty, militarism.
Yeah. King argued you cannot solve racism without addressing poverty and militarism. They feed each other. It's a systemic analysis that feels absolutely essential for understanding the interconnected crises we face right now and for even starting to form sophisticated solutions.
It forces you to think bigger.
Definitely. And finally, maybe a universal insight. Greatness seems rooted in growth through adversity. His life just shows that moral heroism isn't reserved for special people. It's available to ordinary people who are willing to constantly evolve, willing to maintain hope. Not as a feeling, but as a conscious choice, maybe?
Chosen optimist.
Yeah, chosen optimism. And who are willing, crucially, to pay the personal price for their deepest principles.
Absolutely. I think the biographer's real success here is in humanizing King so much that his achievements actually become more inspiring, not less.
Agreed.
The ultimate challenge his full life poses to us, perhaps, isn't whether we can achieve his level of fame or his rhetorical brilliance. It's whether we can muster his level of commitment to justice, to love, to that difficult chosen hope right in our own communities, even when, especially when it costs us popularity or comfort.
That commitment, each shows, that's the real price of the dream.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.